Welcome to News and Brews. I'm Mike Heslin.
And I'm Errol Yabuke.
Errol, it's our second episode of the year, and the hits just keep on coming. Schools are shutting down extremely close to home. We'll feature a rant on that one. And we've got the Texas synagogue facing hours of terror as its rabbi and others were taken hostage over the weekend.
And in international news, we head south to Chile, where the new president feels like two steps forward, but we can't be so sure the arc of politics indeed bends towards progress.
In less Chile news, we could be on the verge of a hot war between Russia and Ukraine. And meanwhile, Novak Djokovic seems to be confounding all sides of Australia's politics.
That guy. But before we start the show, we'd love to hear from you. What do you like about the show? What do you want more of? What should we be paying more attention to? What should we change? You can find us on Twitter and Instagram at News and Brews Pod, or email us at thenewsandthebrews@gmail.com.
Hey, Errol.
Hey, Mike. Good to see you.
Wonderful to see you. Wonderful to be back to our Tuesday night recording when we don't have to feel as guilty about drinking beers.
You don't normally drink beers on Tuesdays? You don't have to answer that question.
Not the midday, midweek. That move is a little too strong for me.
Midday, midweek was you last week. This is at least the evening.
That's what I'm saying. It's nice. It's nice to be back.
It is nice. It's nice to get in the groove again and to see your smiling face on a Tuesday evening.
Speaking of the groove again, it is just the 2022 of our discontent continues. I don't want to give away the show content, but this is another banger.
Yeah, I think we're gonna cover some things that people are thinking about.
Yeah, what's fueling?
How'd you like that for foreshadowing? That was like super specific.
Really, give the people just a taste. What are you drinking?
Oh, I am drinking DC's own Dance of Days Pale Ale from Atlas Brew Works. Honestly, it's a go-to, and I actually got onto this beer because there is a coffee shop / brunch place in Adams Morgan that you probably know called Trist that used to have this on tap. And so I feel like I tried it there first and was like, this is a really just solid pale ale. And so when I saw it at the store with its quintessential solar powered beer label, I figured I'd pick one up.
You know, the Dance of Days, I'm not drinking it right now, but I know it well. It's like an old friend that like 10 years ago knew all the hippest bars and restaurants in the city. And now like has, you know, kids and doesn't leave the house anymore. But is still like really solid, still has like some good insights every week on the podcast. That's what the Dance of Days is.
Are we still talking in theoreticals?
No projection here.
You're talking about the guy who thought drinking beer from a coffee shop tap is cool.
So.
Are you drinking, Mike?
I'm drinking the Z Morris Blonde Ale from Black Flag Brewing Company. That's Z Morris, the closest they can get to Zach Morris without any sort of copyright infringement, because the can basically is like the background is like the early 90s Dixie cup pattern.
Yeah.
You know, the teal definitely. with the purple squiggle. And then over top of it is basically a ripoff of the Saved by the Bell logo that says Z Morris. And the beer is delicious. More importantly, the hand feel of the can, you feel like you're holding an old big cell phone from 1988. It's just,
I feel like
just
that's
delightful.
Important. The hand feel is really important. I have to say, I wouldn't have gotten the reference because, believe it or not, I have never seen an episode of Saved by the Bell.
I absolutely do not believe this, and you need to tell me more.
So I grew up in Turkey in the 1990s, and so I thought that everyone listened to Boys to Men and Ace of Base only, because that was all that was playing on Turkish radio.
That is accurate. That's true.
So far we're good. And I wasn't aware of this pop culture phenomenon that is Saved by the Bell. And so when I got to college in the early 2000s, people were making all these references to like Zach Morris and all this stuff. And I like kind of played along as you do when you're in college, because you want to sound cool. But like one of my friends was like, you have no idea what you're talking about, dude. And I was like, I have no idea what you're talking about. And so he like, instead of sitting me down and making me watch this thing, which I like, have a feeling at that point, I probably wouldn't have liked it. I feel like it was like, if you were an early teen and it came on, probably it was like the coolest thing ever. But if you watched an episode now, it'd probably be like the worst thing ever, perhaps.
I can't say. It's ensconced too deep in my heart.
Fair enough. Wait, where did the beer come from?
Black Flag Brewing Company, which is based out of Columbia, Maryland.
Interesting. I feel like
it's Maryland, actually a really solid beer. I'm really enjoying it.
Maryland's coming out, like Frederick's got a bunch of like, you know,
Frederick's breweries. Got a whole ecosystem. Yeah. Yeah. It's good.
Okay. I'm into it. You and your Maryland, Mike. we've got a lot to cover this week. Shall we dive right in?
Let's do it.
So we're going to start this week pretty much how we ended last week. Pretty heavy. Over the weekend, an armed man named Malik Faisal Akram flew from the UK to take four people hostage at the Congregation Beth Israel Synagogue in Colleyville, Texas. So it was all over cable news. It was really one of the bigger stories, certainly of the weekend and probably of 2022. After a 10-hour siege, the FBI entered the building. They killed the guy and thankfully were able to free all the hostages. He had released one earlier, but there were three left. They were able to free them.
They basically escaped, right? The hostages, like, there was an interesting article, I think it was in the Times, about this, where all these synagogues across the country, because there have been so many threats and actual acts of violence against Jews over the last 5 years or so, have gone through like trainings and basically preparation for emergencies just like this one. And so the rabbi and one of the other hostages described how they basically, like, you know, built a rapport talking with the attacker, inched themselves closer and closer to the door over time, positioned themselves so they could use different items around the room as defense or as weapons, and eventually just picked their moment and made their move and got out.
Yeah. And the FBI was there to, you know, get them out. And it's a sad indictment of the state of, you know, religion around the world, that people have to have preparation drills like that. But I'm glad they were prepared. But anyways, during the siege, apparently the assailant, Akram, kept going on and on about some Pakistani neuroscientist, Dr. Aifa Siddiqui. She's suspected of having ties to Al-Qaeda. She's serving out a long prison sentence in Texas. So presumably that's why the guy came over from the UK, because he was wanting to like trade the hostages to get her out or something. That was kind of baffling to everyone, including the scientist lawyers, who were like, we want nothing to do with this guy, because they're trying to get him out. They're trying to get the scientist out of prison. And the assailant's own family, the guy's family back in the UK, was like, we have no idea, like, this is totally random, no connection with that scientist. So it seemed very kind of off the wall. But as I was tracking this over the weekend, there was a number of things. So, you know, everybody had a hot take. So whether or not this was an act of terror,
I feel like we don't know enough yet. It for sure seems like, you know, targeting a synagogue and having some aim aside from inflicting violence on the immediate victims. Like, is that what defines terror? But like, or was this guy truly just mentally ill? That doesn't seem to have any connection to any broader organization. But, you know, like, was the arson of the Fox News Christmas tree terror?
I mean, according to Fox News, he was.
Well, according to Fox News, it was the greatest crisis our country's ever faced. But like, as we learned more, it appeared that it was just a mentally ill person who had the means and did a crazy thing. And I don't know that we can rule that theory out in this case yet.
Yeah, and a lot of the evidence points to that. I mean, ultimately, you know, whether or not it was, as we're debating here, was a huge topic of conversation of the weekend. And, you know, are we going to call it radical Islamic terror? And, you know, does anti-Semitism...
The most helpful question they call that.
Yes, that is the most helpful question. Much like it's really helpful for us to talk about the reaction rather than just the event, which we're really good at doing. I think people were also rightly debating kind of the state of anti-Semitism in the United States and whether or not some people were even debating whether or not it exists, which seems silly to me.
Seems sort of asked and answered, doesn't it?
Yeah. And then the other thing that I saw people debating or talking about was how this person who literally just got off a plane from the UK got weapons. And the answer to that, Mike, is?
Because Texas.
Because Texas is the correct answer. All jokes aside, I mean, it was really kind of a harrowing and very sad thing. I mean, I'm really glad that the hostages obviously made it out. And my thoughts are with the Jewish community. I mean, who I can't believe that they have to do like hostage drills after, you know, Shabbat. It's crazy. No one should have to be in a house of worship or even a public place and be in that kind of fear.
Yeah. Amen to that. It was a very scary several hours while this was all going down. And I just echo you that glad that none of the hostages were killed or seriously hurt and, you know, constant vigilance.
Definitely.
Let's check in on the zeitgeist of the data-driven millennial parent community, which I know is near and dear to 2 out of 2 podcast hosts here.
You know, so, apparently I'm a millennial. Did you know that? Like millennials are what, 1980?
82, I think.
82. Yeah, so I'm 82.
Or maybe it's 80. I don't know. You're sort of like Xennial, elder millennial cusp.
Yeah, I feel like there was a New York Times article about this a while back and I was like, yes, that's me. And then of course I promptly forgot what it was. Anyways, please continue.
So last week we were in a, like, what about us? Won't someone please think of the children doom spiral, which I think came through pretty clearly on the last episode.
Coincidentally, that was a Michael Jackson song.
Yeah, that sounds right. This week, a few things have happened. Most immediately, my 3-year-old's classroom has shut down for 10 days.
Yikes. Under
the most bullshit circumstances possible. Like, they decided to put 2 classes in the same room for like 20 minutes on Friday afternoon and someone in the other class tested positive the next day. And it's just not acceptable. So somehow the DC government treats daycare centers totally differently from schools. And the kids need to quarantine longer now than they did like a year ago. Like when there was a potential exposure last year, it was like after 3 to 5 days, get a negative test.
Right.
Now it's like 10 days quarantine, no other options.
I don't understand.
Oh, like this, it's this like hair trigger shutdown instinct that's just destructive at this point.
Yeah, well, I'm sorry. Well,
at the same time, more data has been coming in about kids and COVID. So the number of kids in the US dying from COVID is lower than from the flu, pneumonia, heart disease, drowning, firearms, or motor vehicles. One concern over the last couple of years has been this multi-system inflammatory syndrome, MISC for short, where, you know, various systems of the body shut down as a result of the immune response to COVID. Looking at the numbers on that, now that we're a couple of years in, there have been 41 deaths in the US out of 3.7 million cases among children. So that is 0.001%.
That's not a whole lot.
The overall estimated death rate for kids with COVID on the high end, there are a range of estimates, but on the high end is 0.03%. Compare that to the death rate for RSV, which we do not let shut down entire classrooms. It's 0.5%. That means kids are 16 times as likely to die of RSV as of COVID.
Yeah. I mean, are they worried about the kids at this point or just the like faculty and staff, or like, what's the messaging?
Well, so everyone else is eligible to get vaccinated at this point. And we've got antivirals spinning up.
Yeah.
So this week, the WHO said that kids don't even need boosters. There has been a new risk identified that we should call out, which is that experts in the UK have reported that kids are at risk of becoming, quote, fussy eaters, end quote, if their sense of smell is distorted by COVID.
I wonder if they're fussy because like shit gets keep like put up their nose.
Yeah, or because they're kids, who knows? all to say, we are no longer in what about us, think of the children mode. We are fully in fuck it mode. And it's time to reassess how we think about the risks of COVID to kids. Everyone above the age of 5 can get vaccinated. Antivirals are in production. The risk infected kids pose to other people is dropping. The risk to the kids themselves is extremely low. Like, there is no reason we need to be shutting down entire classrooms and entire schools at the faintest hint of an exposure.
I feel like you've thought about this a little bit today.
It's been a dominant force. I'll say that.
Were you in like work meetings and be like, wait, let me tell you about the zeitgeist.
Honestly, I just feel better already after this little rant.
Well, don't open the New York Times, because I would say my association with your rant right now was reading an article entitled No Shots, No Daycare, Parents of Kids Under 5 Stuck in Grueling Limbo.
Yeah, we're finding our own way out. It's okay.
which I feel like is one of those, you know, there's that joke like, oh, I didn't actually read the story. I just read the headline because I'm an American. And like, no, literally you don't have to read the article in this case. Like, enough said. We will go ahead and link that in the show notes. But yeah, no, I'm glad you feel better. And here's hoping that your challenge is more logistical than medical.
Yes.
So speaking of COVID, the world's best tennis player and only one of three unvaccinated tennis players in the top 100 will not compete in this year's first major tournament, the Australian Open. Of course, those two things are related, the unvaccinated part and the not competing part. Novak Djokovic he originally got an Australian visa and he traveled there because he had received this visa. They had granted him a medical exemption, apparently, because he had recently got COVID. So he shows up in Melbourne, where the Australian Open takes place. And after, I don't know how long, he was detained on January 6th. He was then, after a first court proceeding, he was released on January 10th. They're like, no, you're good. Okay. And then he was detained again on Saturday because it was making its way through the Australian courts. And so this whole time, the whole tennis world is like up in arms. The whole, you know, Australian politicians are giving stump speeches about how he's going to be some, you know, symbol for the unvaxxed and whatever. Fast forward to Sunday, Djoko's on a plane back to Serbia via Dubai on Emirates. I'm sure it was a lovely flight. He received a hero's welcome back in Belgrade, according to Reuters. The man on the verge of winning more major tournaments than any other player in history. Fun fact, he's tied with Nadal and Federer at 20 major victories. He was greeted at the airport by family and friends who, quote, portray him as a persecuted underdog. So Novak Djokovic, the person who has chosen not to be vaccinated against COVID, is a persecuted underdog. Sure.
That's awesome.
And one dude at the airport was even like, quote, I think he entered history as a hero, as a fighter against this evil, which is called Corona Circus. So this is not where it ends for Djoko. I think his decision not to get vaccinated is going to make his life even harder. Apparently the French Open, which is the next major tennis tournament in the calendar, has also said that they will not be granting exceptions to visas for famous tennis players. So his quest to break the record and the tie that he has with Nadal and Federer might have to wait a little bit longer.
Do you know what his reasons are for not getting vaccinated? Didn't he just have COVID?
He's had COVID twice.
And wasn't he like also not particularly forthcoming with the state of his having COVID when he was in the process of getting into Australia? Wasn't that part of this story?
There was a lot of elements to this story, some of which were eerily reminiscent to that NFL quarterback from Green Bay, you know, like I've been inoculated or whatever. Yes, that's the guy. I don't know exactly. And like, this is the part of the internet that tends to infuriate me, so I don't go too deep into it. But yes, he is making a decision. He does not have a medical exemption. He is making a decision.
What I think is interesting about this story is that it doesn't quite cleanly map onto the political narrative landscape. Like in Australia, in specifically, you know, their prime minister is sort of a right wing, not particularly effective or pleasant person. Who, and you know, I should also say that Australia, being the home of Rupert Murdoch, has kind of the same know-nothing, reactionary right-wing element that we do here. But they were sort of at odds, they were conflicted between the anti-vax energy and the anti-immigration energy.
Oh, interesting. So
a big part of their messaging throughout the whole pandemic has been that immigrants are bringing this disease into Australia. And so the Djokovic case, they started off going really hard after it because it fit in really nicely with that narrative. But Djokovic himself, you know, as evidenced by his anti-vax stance, has been a bit of a lightning rod over the years. He's said a lot of things that he shouldn't have said. You know, he also like came out strongly in favor and showing very public support of Peng Shuai, the Chinese tennis player, when she was being persecuted by the Chinese Communist Party. So complex individual and
yeah, he's really complex there. Actually. Yeah.
But it's just interesting to see sort of the political factions be a little bit confounded by this story. You know, I don't particularly watch a lot of tennis, but it's also just interesting when someone who is at the top of their game is involved in something like this that really has nothing to do with tennis itself.
Yeah. And I think to his slight credit, he sort of took his punishment pretty gracefully and you know, got on the plane and was like, I respect the ruling and obviously I'm disappointed, but you know, I respect or whatever. I just think like, some of the argument that I've heard from other people when talking about Djokovic is like, look, this is a fit person in the peak of his, you know, he's in the prime. He's had COVID twice. Like he's worried about any potential side effects of this external thing. You know, he's not worried about getting COVID. He's had it twice. He was fine, which laying aside the fact that my own personal feelings and reactions when people say like that, is apparently where he's coming from. And I think that, like I said, it's just going to get harder for him to like exist in the world.
That's kind of why I asked, if that is in fact his reason, if it's just, I don't want a foreign substance entering my body, which is this miracle life-saving vaccine, that's really damaging because that's just sowing skepticism and baseless denial of the vaccine's efficacy and safety that like a lot of people look up to this person around the world. There's no reason for that.
Which is ultimately, I think, where the Australian politicians landed in reconciling this, you know, internal dispute that they must have been having, as you were saying. I mean, they were basically like, look, we don't want him to be a poster child for the anti-vaxxers in Australia. Yeah. And look, I'm not sure that the Australian authorities handled everything particularly well. I mean, I like that they treated him like anybody else. I do, you know, they sent him to the hotel where all the asylum seekers were, you know, for example, and didn't give him special treatment. But at the same time, you know, he's making a choice and he's got to live with that choice. And I think the Australians ultimately, personal opinion, I think the Australians did the right thing. Let's move on to Ukraine. Last week we talked about Ukraine and it was sort of looking like and has been looking like for a few weeks that Russia is amassing troops on the border and is looking to invade. And so in the latest evidence of the news and brews bump in the last week, lots of people seem to be paying attention to Ukraine all of a sudden, including a bipartisan group of 7 U.S. senators who got on a plane to Kyiv. They met with President Volodymyr, not to be confused with the other Vladimir Zelensky, the Ukrainian president, and other senior officials. So I think this trip was pretty significant, actually. There were three Republicans and four Democrats that went. And I think they were sending a pretty clear message. So Rob Portman, Republican of Ohio, said, quote, "To Russia, we stand with the Ukrainian people and with this government. In fact, Congress recently passed an increase to $300 million in security funding to Ukraine." So in addition to the new money, the Biden administration is threatening to wield everyone's favorite weapon, which is what?
That'd be unprecedented sanctions.
Exactly. Against Russia, and has also talked about some other types of military assistance. And
that was the famed weapon in the classic movie, Doctor Strange Rhetoric.
That's great. I mentioned the bipartisanship here, and I wanted to go on a quick tangent because this is news and brews, and we like politics here. Last week, the Senate voted against imposing sanctions on Nord Stream 2 AG, which is a company that is behind the pipeline that's meant to deliver gas from Russia to Germany. So you may have heard Nord Stream. It's been kind of like this lightning rod that nobody knows exactly what it is. And so I'm not going to go into all the details, but essentially it's a company that built this pipeline. Ted Cruz has been on a literal crusade to get sanctions against this company. And he's been like holding up ambassadorship hearings and other confirmation hearings. Like he's basically like grind the Biden administration to a halt because he wants sanctions for this company. That is apparently the hill that Ted Cruz has decided to not die on because he's Ted Cruz and he's never going to die. And so his bill, which he views as essentially punishing Russia, it actually got all the Republicans, but it actually got six Democratic votes, but it ultimately fell short of the 60 votes that would have been needed according to the deal that brought it to the floor. And all, you know, I won't go into the details there, but Biden administration was against it, not because they were against like punishing Russia, but they were actually like, look, Russia's about to invade Ukraine. Like maybe we shouldn't piss off Germany, alienate other potential allies in Europe. Like there's maybe some other ways to do this, including a bill that's being floated by Democratic Senator Bob Menendez. But I'm getting the sense that people are freaked out over this. And like, there's even new research reports and news reports about like, if Russia was going to invade, this is how they might do it.
And like the O.J. Simpson, if I did it.
Just if I did it, if the glove fit, you know. But yeah, so it's getting a little scary. Secretary of State Tony Blinken is actually going to be there Wednesday of this week to meet again with President Zelensky to, quote unquote, show support for the sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. So I would say for a non-NATO member, all this activity is pretty clearly signaling to Russia that like the West is not giving up on Ukraine yet.
Yeah, there definitely feels, I agree with your analysis. Like it feels like the talk about war has become much more realistic. Do we think it was maybe just a mistake to put someone named Blinken in the top negotiating role? Like I could see Yellen working for that, or just like Steadfast, Steely. We need a better name in there, I think.
Yeah, I mean, the two guys who seem to be energized the most about this are named Blinken and Cruz. So not sure that we're ratcheting up the intensity.
Should we move on to our main story?
Let's do it.
We're going to go to South America this episode.
Have we ever had a main story come from South America?
I was thinking about that. We did the Cuba protest story. I don't remember if that was the main news or not.
We did. And it's shocking to me that we actually haven't talked about Venezuela on this podcast. We should talk about Venezuela. We should talk about Nicaragua.
For the record, really I'm aware that Cuba is not in South America.
Thanks for coming to my TED Talk.
Chile has elected its youngest ever president, Gabriel Boric, who just barely met the age requirement of 35 to be eligible to run. To formally congratulate the president-elect, Finland's 37-year-old Prime Minister Sanna Marin sent Boric a 4 a.m. selfie that showed her ripping a joint in an OK Boomer sweatshirt. So there's been just a really interesting history and trajectory in Chilean politics. So I'll share some of the headlines here. In 1970, they elected Salvador Allende president. He was a socialist, This was the height of the Cold War. The CIA didn't really like that. So they backed a coup and installed the commander of the army, Augusto Pinochet, into the presidency.
Bad idea.
Pinochet then ruled for the next 17 years under a mix of brutal military dictatorship and extreme capitalism. State-sponsored torture and killing on a massive scale, throwing political opponents out of helicopters, stripping away public goods and the social safety net basically was the norm. If you want to see some of the horrific stuff the CIA was involved in across Latin America at this point, check out Operation Condor, just Wikipedia that. It was basically an extended campaign of coordinated state terror. CIA essentially presented as a gift to Pinochet on his 60th birthday.
My goodness.
Fast forward to the 2000s, and Chile at that point had shaken the dictatorship, but really retained a good deal of Pinochet's kind of Chicago-style free market capitalism that was all enshrined in the constitution that he created. In 2006 and 2011, you see cracks start to form in this system in the form of massive student protests, initially in favor of free public education. Boric, at this point, was president of the University of Chile Student Federation, and he was a leader of those 2011 protests in which one student was killed, several hundred students and police officers were injured, and about 1,800 were arrested. I will say that's a little bit different from how I remember student council.
Yeah, and in your time at, like, this dude ended up as president. So weren't you president of, like, the Dartmouth something or other? You're going to be president of the United States. Is that the main takeaway from this story?
It was the college Dems. It was not the student council. I don't think we're quite on the same trajectory, Boric and I. Those student protests actually kept kind of recurring in 2013, 2015. We get up to 2019, and what started as protests over public transit fare increases in Santiago ballooned into massive nationwide protests against corruption, cost of living, and inequality. And this time it wasn't just students. And you have these just massive movements that started in Santiago and just expanded across the whole country. So 36 dead, 12,000 injured, and 28,000 arrested in those 2019-2020 protests.
Yeah, I remember that. You weren't expecting to see that in a place like Chile that had been this, you know, bastion of commerce and stability since Pinochet fell.
Totally. And in many ways, Boric's victory is seen as a successful outcome of those protests. But it's not the first one or even potentially the most significant. And that's because in 2020, they held a national plebiscite asking if they should rewrite the legacy Pinochet constitution. And the yes side won with a whopping 78% of the vote.
Wow. Like, rewrite it how?
So we'll get to that. It's actually expected to be pretty significant. Like, they may remove some of the executive powers that the president has. They may restructure the whole legislature. But it's expected to be pretty big.
Also want to go back to how you differentiated between student council and student government and like college Dems, because I thought that was really cute.
thanks.
News and Brews listener and good buddy of mine, Steven, and I, when we were at the University of Texas, always used to call our student government friends student council. And let me tell you how much they really liked it.
We're all adults on all sides. Also worth mentioning about this 2021 presidential election that Boric just won, his opponent was a self-styled Trump Bolsonaro wannabe who openly praised Pinochet, railed against things like marriage equality and political correctness, and wanted to build a ditch along Chile's border to keep immigrants out.
Yeah. So instead of a wall, they went with the ditch.
That's right.
Is there going to be like water? Is it like a moat? Like water.
You know, I didn't really research the specific engineering decisions around the ditch. I'm just kind of glad we don't have to talk about it anymore because that guy got worked in the runoff against Boric.
Yeah, build the ditch just doesn't have the same ring to it.
So the constitutional convention is still going on. Boric will be in charge while it works, but not in charge of the convention itself. Generally expected that the rewrite of the constitution will move the nation leftward from kind of the hard right starting point, but it's not clear exactly how the constitutional work will align with or possibly derail Boric's agenda. So as I mentioned, it could eliminate some presidential powers like the veto. The legislature is very narrowly split, and the legislature actually could be cut from a bicameral to a unicameral. Like they're looking at really significant structural changes here.
Interesting. So like, bicameral to unicameral, meaning there's only one house of parliament. Like there's not an upper house and a lower house.
Right. It's also not clear exactly where Boric will align and be positioned politically over time. He's clearly on the left, but he's not a part of the Communist Party, which is left of where he is. He's not even part of one of the major coalitions in Chile. So Chile has something like a two-party system. They have a two-coalition system that basically these two coalitions have alternated power over the last several decades. But Boric is not part of either one.
Interesting.
And I think being a young, charismatic leader coming in with, you know, with a mandate, like, I think it's hard not to have high expectations that basically set everyone up to be disappointed.
Yeah, I was thinking about this story and what's happening in Chile and whether there are analogies to what's happening in the United States. And because I was also reading some articles about how people within Biden's sphere are, worried that things are going too far left and he needs to come to the center. And obviously a lot of this is like Washington, D.C. back and forth kind of BS. But it does make me think about, you know, this sort of arc of progress is not linear and oftentimes will go kind of further in one direction and then bounce even further in another direction. So if you think of Barack Obama and passing the ACA, everybody mm-hmm. thought that was super left. And now, you know, people can't imagine living without it. And then, you know, Trump bounced so far to the other way and then we're bouncing back. And like, we're probably going to end up somewhere that's left of center. And so I wonder if Boric just kind of represents from the get-go that left of center end space.
Yeah, you just hope that it's not being set up for a reaction in the other direction, right? No matter what, it's great to see another millennial in power across the world. There are a number now, not least of whom is our favorite 37-year-old 4 a.m. club goer in Finland.
You know she sent him a WhatsApp. You know,
but no, I think the other thing that I would call out is if you look, and we've talked about this in the past, if you look at what Steve Bannon and Tucker Carlson are doing, like messing around with Viktor Orban in Hungary and playing footsie with Putin and, you know, cozying up to Bibi Netanyahu, like there is this international organization of energy and people and agendas on the right. And I think that, you know, to have at least similar lines of communication on the left, to have at least some acknowledgement of shared principles and recognition of the shared threats faced by folks on the left in America and leaders like Boric is really valuable and really important. So I hope that we see some of that emerge from this era.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting whether it's not just sort of millennial to millennial, but kind of countries that have like-minded approaches. Like I'm not holding out that like Bolsonaro and Biden are going to be besties at any point, but you know, someone like Boric and someone like Biden could actually, or maybe someone like Vice President Harris could, you know, strike up a, not just a friendship, but like a sharing of ideas. And, you know, I think that there are quite a few parallels between Chile and the United States. Chile is obviously a much smaller country than the United States, but there's, in terms of education levels, in terms of political breakdown, important economic role in the region type thing. So I could see, remains to be seen what happens in Chile and whether Boric can kind of use this power for whatever purposes that he deems necessary. But I think that there's reason to believe that this could happen elsewhere as well. And look, I think the reality, Mike, is that there will be backlash in some points. I mean, like many people think that Trump was a result of a backlash against Obama and mm-hmm. one can only hope that there's not going to be kind of a backlash, but I think it could happen in places. I think my point though, is that like, if this is a pendulum, the sort of middle of the pendulum kind of keeps moving a little bit. And hopefully that middle point is towards progress.
Yeah, no, I think you certainly are seeing a generational shift in Chile, not just because it's a young leader, but because you've got so much of the voting populace now that was not really around for the Pinochet dictatorship, that doesn't have those same scars, at least in a direct way, but that has just new ways of thinking about the world. So good stuff there. I mean, I think the concern about the pendulum swinging is all the more potent because they are facing a real economic crisis right now. They're facing a lot of trouble with COVID. You know, they've got real challenges ahead for this leader, not even putting aside the parallel constitutional convention that's happening and the closely divided legislature. It'll be something worth watching.
Indeed. And we will probably cover it here on News and Brews. So we had in last episode, we had started a new segment that we had called at the time Hot Tips.
Yeah, Hot Tips are out. We had a great listener suggestion. This last segment is now called Spicy Nuggets.
I'm totally into it. I'm really into this. I like spicy nuggets.
So Errol, what's your spicy nugget for this week?
So my spicy nugget, I've already texted you and I've texted pretty much every other person I knew because like, it's not often that I like actually lol. And I was like chortling when I was reading this thing. So McSweeney's, which is a pretty go-to spot for spot on lists. It's sort of like the BuzzFeed for like slightly older than BuzzFeed people.
It's
maybe.
It's like the most exennial publication, I think. It's good.
And so this guy, John Moe, which of course his name is Moe, came up with this article entitled What Your Favorite Sad Dad Band Says About You. And so I saw the title and I was like, oh shit, like this is going to be a lot about me. And sure enough. So what's interesting is like, I didn't actually know a lot of the bands or some of the bands and some of them I did. Like I used to love Death Cab for Cutie and they talk about Death Cab for Cutie as like Academia was not made up to be everything you wanted it to be. But actually my wife pointed out that there's a band called The National that was to the word pretty like jarringly spot on. So with your indulgence, I'm going to read what the post for The National was.
Please do.
The National. You should have moved to Brooklyn when you had the chance. You never had the chance. At what point does the artisanal whiskey interest become just alcoholism with a higher word count? You used to think you were once great at soccer, but now you're not so sure you were ever good at soccer. This is causing a very low-level existential crisis that will vanish in 3 years.
It was really good.
I was like, shit.
I on one level really enjoyed this when you sent it to me. On another level was just aghast at how real it was. But as I was reading, I like obviously was like looking for the bands that I really liked. So Death Cab for Cutie and Modest Mouse were probably like my two favorite bands on that list. And I basically found myself also being a combination of the two descriptions there. So I'm not going to read them out because it's really worth, you know, we'll link this in the show notes. It's really worth checking out, but just very well done.
Also, I'd like to say a fond farewell to the 2 to 5 listeners that we just lost by admitting that we are Death Cab for Cutie hardcore fans.
No regrets. So my spicy nug this week is related to two things that happened in the last week in my life. One is we had a company retreat for First 90, my day job. And it was sort of a, you know, kicking off the new year. We're all remote. So a chance to come together and just talk about some meaty stuff. I also on Tuesday of this week did a guest lecture that I do each quarter for some undergrads in a leadership development program at Dartmouth. And so that's all about the importance of like project management to leadership. And in both of these events, my retreat and the guest lecture, OKRs play a central role. Do you know what OKRs are, Errol?
No.
It stands for Objectives and Key Results. And it's a goal setting system that was initially invented by Andy Grove at Intel, that was eventually taken by a former Intel engineer and very prominent venture capitalist, John Doerr, to Google, where it became the way that they operated and still do, to sort of align goals and measure them and focus on the most important things throughout the organization. And anyway, I find them to be really helpful in business and in strategic planning.
Is it like the Sigma, whatever the number, insert number here, Sigma thing where it's like how to do project management? Like what, how do you find it useful?
No, it's much lighter weight. It's more about basically as a leader of an organization, you identify like what are the most important three or four things that we are working on, and you articulate those as your objectives, and you define key results, which are like the measurable metrics and results that define achievement of those objectives. And then you're able to sort of cascade that throughout the organization. So you make sure that everyone's objectives are aligned. You make sure that everything's super clear and measurable, and there's no gray area in whether something has been achieved or not. And it has proven to be an extremely effective way to get things done. It's also quite straightforward to implement. And obviously there are ways to do it well and not well. I just thought that it would be worth sharing, because I don't think that actually it people in business world, the private sector, typically are familiar with OKRs and often have used them. They're in use across like something like 40 industries, including the public sector. But I think that like public sector policy people are a little bit less management focused. And so it would make sense that not everyone's been exposed to this. So there's a great like primer from Wired Magazine a few years back called When John Doerr Brought a Gift to Google's Founders. And that gift was OKRs. So we'll link it in the show notes if anyone's interested in like nerding out on some management concepts. Check it out.
Two things. One, I am interested. Color me interested, and I will nerd out on this. And two, I wouldn't consider myself a representative sample of people in the policy world, so I'm sure there's lots of better people than I who have heard of this and are even deploying it across the federal government.
Awesome. Great nuggets this week.
Good nuggets, nice and spicy. Definitely hot. Mike, great to see you.
Great to see you too, Errol.
See you next week.
Thanks for listening, everyone. News and Brews is hosted by Mike Heslin and Errol Yabuke. Our producer is Alana Nevins. This episode was recorded Tuesday, January 18th, 2022 at 9 p.m. Eastern Time. Look out for new episodes available each Wednesday on all major podcast platforms. Thanks for listening.